Good afternoon. My name is Fabio Licinius, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum and Dickinson College, I'd like to welcome you to the 2010 Winfield C. Cook Constitution Day Address. This annual address is endowed through the generosity of Winfield C. Cook, a former Dickinson trustee. Each year, the Clark Forum invites a prominent public figure to campus to speak on a contemporary issue related to the Constitution. The event celebrates the United States Constitution while commemorating Dickinson's connection to it. Previous Constitution Day speakers include Chief Justice William H. Rehnquist, Marjorie O. Rendell, Kenneth Starr, and speaking at last year's address, Tom Ridge. Introducing this afternoon's speaker is the Honorable Johnny Jones, an alumnus of both Dickinson College and the Dickinson School of Law. In 2007, Judge Jones presided over the famous case, Kitzmiller v. Dover, which dealt with teaching intelligent design as an alternative to evolution in public schools. He was recently named one of the 25 most influential graduates of Dickinson College. At this time, I would like to ask that you turn off all cell phones and electronic devices. Also, please hold all questions until the question and answer session following Professor Chemerinsky's speech. Because this event is being taped and some audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait until the microphone has been brought to you before beginning to speak. The program will end by 1:10 to allow time for lunch and arriving to class on time. And now, please join me in welcoming the Honorable Johnny Jones.
Should we, do we have this fixed? Okay, why don't we kill it for the moment, and I'll project, because the dean has a wireless mic on so that we're not echoing here. Well, welcome all of you. It's my with great pride and pleasure that I introduce my friend, who is your Constitution Day speaker for this afternoon's program. Dean Erwin Chemerinsky is one of the most prominent United States constitutional law and federal civil procedure scholars. He is the current and founding dean of the University of California Irvine School of Law, which began classes in the fall semester just recently. Dean Chemerinsky was raised in Chicago, and he received his undergraduate degree from Northwestern University, and he attended and graduated from Harvard Law School. For over 20 years, Dean Chemerinsky taught law students throughout the United States at the University of Southern California School of Law, DePaul University College of Law, and Duke University before becoming the founding dean at the law school at UC Irvine. Now, in addition to teaching law at that school, and I say this for my friends, in the political science department here at Dickinson, he has also taught undergraduate political science as well. He has written at least, by my count, 7 books, maybe more, including casebooks. Casebooks, I know we have some law students here, undoubtedly used by the law students and law students across the country, most notably on constitutional law. He's regularly argued appellate cases, both criminal and civil, typically pro bono. That means he's not getting paid in the Supreme Court, federal courts of appeals, and state Supreme Courts. He regularly, for those of you who watch the news, I hope you do, and that you're engaged, he appears in the media. I saw my friend recently commenting on the Proposition 8 trial in California on network television. Years ago, before your time, those of you who are students here, he was a commentator for the O.J. Simpson trial on CBS and other networks. So he's multifaceted and he multitasks very easily, as you can see. He is passionate about legal education, legal scholarship, service to the community, and to his profession. And I make this additional comment echoing my friend, former Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. Dean Chemerinsky has said that judicial activism is a label for the decision that people don't like. That's music to my ears, having toiled as a federal judge now for 8 years and having rendered a few decisions that a number of people are not particularly happy with at times. He also, for those of you who are either pointing towards the law as undergraduates or who are now attending law school, you will see Dean Chemerinsky turn up in your BARBRI review course as you study for the bar. And I will tell you that he does that without notes. He does it from memory. And he does practically everything from memory. And he puts me to shame because I have notes in my hands. I've had the pleasure of serving on a couple of programs with Dean Chemerinsky. Most recently, we did some tough duty in St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands at a conference there last January. And he wanted, once again, as he did the first time we were together, put me to shame because he operated from memory. This judge must operate with notes. I need to have a net as I speak to you. He is a friend of mine. He is a great scholar. He is a true force of nature as it relates to education, as it relates to love of the law and learning of the law. I'm very honored to have you here at Dickens today, Dean Erwin Chemerinsky.
We're split.
In conflicts among the federal courts of appeals and the district courts over the longer time before being settled. It's much harder to get a case heard by the Supreme Court. Judge Jones, my guess is you'd love your only 73 cases on your docket. And there is another less noted implication from the smaller docket. As the number of cases has gone down, the length of opinions has gone up. Now, I'm not sure what's caused and what's effect. Are the justices taking fewer cases because they want to write longer opinions? Or, as I would guess, are they writing longer opinions because they have fewer cases? I've not yet done the arithmetic, but I think this just completed term will set the record for the longest average number of pages and words per opinion I was surprised when on January 21st, when the court handed down an important campaign finance case, Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, I'll talk about, the opinions total 157 pages long. But it's nothing compared to the case that came down on June 28th, that I'll also talk about, McDonald versus City of Chicago, about the Second Amendment. It was 220 pages long. Now, one of the things I have to do every July is to do the annual supplements to my constitutional law and criminal procedure papers. I have discovered there's no way to edit 157-page opinion, let alone a 220-page opinion, and an assignment handled for law students in one night without making a handle. So I want to start a new campaign, and I ask you to join me in it. Word and page limits should be imposed on the United States Supreme Court. But the bottom line is we talk about what the Supreme Court's going to do, but the role of the Supreme Court in American government and American society is a much smaller role than it used to be. The second theme I'd identify for you, I think, is the most important to understanding Roberts' work. It's really the Anthony Kennedy Court. I know out of tradition, in deference to Chief, refer to this as the Roberts Court. But at least from the perspective of lawyers who stand before the justice to write briefs to them, this is the Anthony Kennedy Court. Last year, Anthony Kennedy was in the majority more than the other justice, 93% of the time. Before that, Anthony Kennedy was in the majority more than the other justice, 93% of the time. But when you really see that this is the Anthony Kennedy Court is by focusing on the 5-4 decisions. After
all, are usually the most difficult and the most controversial cases.
Through each of the 5 years in which John Roberts has been Chief Justice, Anthony Kennedy has been the majority of more 5-4 decisions than any other justice. Last year, out of 73 cases, 16 were 5-4. Anthony Kennedy was the majority in 13, the most of the justices. Few were that, there were 75 decisions. 23 were 5-4. Justice Kennedy was the majority in 18, the most of any justice. A couple of years before that, there were 24 5-4 decisions. Justice Kennedy was the majority in literally every one of them. As a lawyer, there's often the sense of arguing to an audience of one. I have a case, next week I'll hear if the Supreme Court's going to take it. And if they do, well, you know, in all honesty, my brief will be a shameless attempt to pander to Justice Kennedy. If I could put Anthony Kennedy's picture on the front of my brief. In my brief won't be unique among those in the case. The case won't be unique among those on the docket. Everyone knows. Even the justices know. It's the Anthony Kennedy Court. Well, this leads me to my third theme. And the one I want to spend the most time developing. Most conservative Supreme Court that there's been since the mid-1930s. Now, if you're politically conservative, you can applaud over this. If you're politically liberal, you can lament it. But the reality is, overall, this is a very conservative court. Now, it's easy to explain this in terms of the individuals on the court. John Roberts and Samuel Alito have been everything that conservatives could have hoped for, the liberals could have feared. When the court split 5-4, they're almost always together with Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas, who are as conservative as any justices who sat on the United States Supreme Court. On the other side, at least through last year, you had Justices Stevens, Ginsburg, Breyer, and Sotomayor, who would usually be together. By focusing on the 5-4 decisions where the justices split along traditional ideological lines. there were 12 cases like that. 12 cases were on the one hand with Roberts, Scalia, Thomas, and Alito. And on the other were Stevens, Ginsburg, Breyer, and Sotomayor. Justice Kennedy voted with the conservatives in 9 of those 12 cases, and with the liberals in 3 of those cases. The year before that, there were 16 cases split 5-4 along ideological lines. Again, on one side were Roberts, Scalia, Thomas, and Alito. That term on the other were Stevens, Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer. Justice Kennedy sided with the conservatives in 11, with the liberals in 5. If you look at the 5 years of the Roberts split, Justice Kennedy has sided with the conservatives significantly more often than twice as often with the liberals than the court split 5-4. Well, what does it mean to say the court is conservative? We could certainly discuss what the terms liberal and conservative mean. In the common political sense, let's equate the Republican Party platform with conservative and the Democratic platform with liberal. It's in this sense that the Supreme Court is much more conservative than liberal. What does it mean, though, to say this? Let me give you some examples from last term and then put it in a larger context. One thing it means is that the court is advancing traditional conservative ideology. An example here, gun rights. I don't know when in American history views on guns came to so track ideology that conservatives tend to favor gun rights and liberals favoring gun control. But it shouldn't then surprise us that the Supreme Court is split on the issue of guns 5-4 exactly along ideological lines. In 1791, when the Second Amendment was adopted, June 26, 2008, never had the Supreme Court found that any law violated the Second Amendment. In the handful of cases dealing with the Second Amendment, the Supreme Court had always said that it protects the right to have firearms only for the purpose of militia service. It was basing this on the text of the Second Amendment, which says a well-regulated militia, being necessary to a free state, granted people to keep in their arms shall not be. But then in June of 2008, the Supreme Court decided District of Columbia versus Heller.
It involved a 35-year-old District of Columbia ordinance that prohibited private ownership and possession of handguns and imposed restrictions on long guns. The Supreme Court, 5-4, declared this invalid. Justice Scalia wrote for the court, joined by Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Thomas, Justice Alito, and Justice Kennedy. Justice Scalia said that the Second Amendment protects the right of individuals to have guns, at least in their home, for purpose of personal security. The District of Columbia, obviously, is a part of the federal government. The Supreme Court had no occasion in that case to consider whether or not the Second Amendment applies to state and local governments. That was McDonald versus City of Chicago, June 28th of this year. I think quite predictably, the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that the Second Amendment does apply to state and local governments. In other words, state and local gun control laws can be challenged as violating the Second Amendment. Same split among the justices. Here, Justice Alito wrote the opinion for the court, joined by Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas, and once more, Justice Kennedy. What does this mean? The courthouse door is now open to challenges to federal, state, and local gun control laws of all sorts. Now, obviously, the Second Amendment right is not absolute. The Supreme Court said the government can keep people having guns in places like schools and airports. The government can keep people who have a felony conviction or a history of serious mental illness from having guns. But for the first time in American history, now federal, state, and local gun control laws are open to challenge. Let me give you a second example of what it means to say this is a conservative court. It's generally a court that's very protective of business and corporations. I can show you countless examples where this court has ruled for business and corporate interests over government regulation. But I think the most important case of last term, maybe the most important in a long time, and it illustrates this, is the case I already alluded to, Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission.
decided January 21st of this year. It involved a provision of the McCain-Feingold Bipartisan Campaign Finance Reform Act of 2001 that limited the ability of corporations and unions to spend money in independent expenditures for broadcast advertising 30 days before a primary or 60 days before a general election. In January of 2003, in a case called McConnell versus Federal Election Commission, the Supreme Court upheld this provision as constitutional. The court relied heavily on a decision from 13 years earlier, Austin versus Michigan Chamber of Commerce, that said that states can restrict corporate spending in elections. These earlier cases, Austin and McConnell, said that corporations, that matter unions, ultimately have the money of their shareholders, of their members, that they shouldn't be spending the money on political things that the shareholders, the members, might disagree with. The Supreme Court expressed great concern over the possibility that corporate and union money could drown out other voices and thus distort the political process. The court also was concerned that if corporations, unions, spend large amounts of money, there might be the appearance of impropriety, the appearance of corruption. Well, you might remember that Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission involved a conservative political action corporation that had made a movie very critical of Hillary Clinton, and it wanted to show it over video on demand. And the issue came before the Supreme Court in October term 2008 as to whether or not this provision of McCain-Feingold applied to the medium of video on demand. The Supreme Court had briefing and oral arguments, and then, to the surprise of everyone, on June 29th, 2009, the court didn't decide the issue, but asked for new briefing and argument as to whether the earlier decisions that I mentioned, McConnell from 2003, Austin from 1990, should be overruled. None of the parties in the litigation asked the Supreme Court to consider overruling the earlier decisions. The Supreme Court did this on its own. And 5-4, the Supreme Court overruled the earlier decisions, and the Supreme Court held that corporations, and by implication unions, can spend as much as they want in independent expenditures to get the candidates they choose elected, the candidates they oppose defeated. It was a 5-4 decision. Justice Kennedy wrote the opinion for the court, and his opinion was joined by Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas, and Justice Alito. Justices Stevens, Ginsburg, Breyer, and Sotomayor dissented. Justice Kennedy said that corporations have the same free speech rights as individuals, that spending money with regard to elections is core political expression protected by the First Amendment. Why do I regard this case as the most important of last year or the last many years? Well, one reason is what it's likely to mean for the political process. What will it mean for our election system when corporations and unions can spend as much as they want to get the candidates of their choice elected, the candidates they oppose defeated? We're already starting to see in this election the effects of unlimited corporate spending. I especially worry for what it might mean for judicial elections in states with elected judges. What will happen when corporations, when unions, can spend money to get judges elected? The judges are going to be hearing cases that are involving those corporations and unions. I worry what it might mean in small towns where one corporation truly does have the money and the influence to drown out other voices. I worry about what this case means for other campaign finance laws. The Supreme Court has said that corporations have the same free speech rights as individuals. Now, it's worth noting here that there was no Supreme Court case in history prior to 1978 that ever protected speech rights of corporations. But now the court has said corporations have the same speech rights as individuals. Well, if that's so, then how can there be limits on campaign contributions by corporations directly to candidates? This case didn't involve contributions from corporations to candidates. In 1907, Congress passed a law saying corporations can't contribute money to candidates for federal elective office. In 1946, Congress passed a law saying unions can't contribute money to candidates for federal elective office. This case just involved independent expenditures by corporations. But once the Supreme Court says, as it did, that corporations have the same speech rights as individuals, and that spending money in elections is core expression of the First Amendment, then how can limits on contributions by corporations or by unions stand? In fact, previously, Justices Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas said that limits on contributions are unconstitutional. And I think there's now likely 5 votes for that. And what will it mean in terms of corruption and the appearance of corruption when corporations and unions can contribute as much as they choose to candidates for elective office? I also think this case is very revealing about the Roberts Court in precedent. Precedent is such a key part of our legal system. It's said to provide stability and predictability. Well, then you got to ask, what changed from January 2003, when the Supreme Court upheld this provision in McConnell, to January 2010, when the court struck it down in Citizens United? Did the court find some musty history of the First Amendment that led it to believe it made a mistake? Had McConnell proven impossible to administer in practice? No, of course not. The difference was that McConnell was 5-4 with Justice O'Connor in the majority. She was replaced by Justice Alito, and the case came out 5-4 the other way. That's the only difference, that Justice Alito replaced Justice O'Connor. And I think point to so many cases in just the first few years of the Roberts Court, where they've overruled precedent, even recent precedent, based on this switch in the court. Another thing that it means that this is a conservative court is that it very much favors law enforcement over the rights of criminal defendants. Again, let me give you an example from last year. It's a case called Burgess versus Tompkins. Burgess versus Tompkins arose in Michigan. A man there was arrested for murder. He was given his Miranda rights. Every child who watched police shows can recite the Miranda rights. He was told he had the right to remain silent, that any statement could be used against him. He had the right to an attorney. If he couldn't afford one, one would provide it. He was asked to sign a statement that he understood his Miranda rights. He refused to do so. For 2 hours and 45 minutes, the police questioned him, and he said nothing. Occasionally he nodded or grunted, but he remained silent. After almost 3 hours of questioning, an officer asked him whether he believed in God. He said yes. The officer then asked him if he prayed to God. Tompkins replied yes. The officer then said, "Will you pray to God for forgiveness for the shooting and killing the person?" Tompkins said yes. The question was, were those 3 one-word answers admissible against Tompkins? Had he waived his right to remain silent with those 3 one-word answers? The statements, the 3 yeses, were key evidence that introduced in the trial against Tompkins, and he was convicted. And the case came to the Supreme Court. It was a 5-4 decision. Justice Kennedy wrote for the court, joined by Roberts, Scalia, Thomas, and Alito. Stevens, Ginsburg, Breyer, and Sotomayor dissented. Justice Kennedy, writing for the court, said that Tompkins had not invoked his right to remain silent. Now, the dissent said, what clearer way is there to invoke a right to remain silent than being silent? For 2 hours and 45 minutes, Tompkins sat there silent. But the Supreme Court said that's not enough to invoke the right to remain silent. A person has to explicitly say, I wish to remain silent, in order to invoke the right to remain silent. And then the court said the 3 one-word answers were a sufficient waiver of the right to remain silent. Justice Kennedy said if he wanted to remain silent, he could have. Once he spoke, he waived that right. Justice Sotomayor, who wrote for the dissent, went back and quoted Miranda versus Arizona from 1966. Miranda said there should be a presumption against finding waiver. A waiver has to be deemed knowing and intelligent. That can't be met here. Justice Sotomayor said the majority has turned Miranda on its head by finding the presumption in favor of, not against, waiver. Now, I mention these three cases because they're all high-profile decisions from last year, but they're also reflective of, I think, the larger conservatism of the Roberts Court. How else will we see it? Well, think about the issues that most separate who's conservative, who's liberal in our society. Abortion. I think on the current court, there are four, to only four justices, who would overrule Roe versus Wade: Roberts, Scalia, Thomas, and Alito. Justice Kennedy has indicated he will not vote to overrule Roe, but will vote to allow regulation of abortion up to the point of a complete ban. So, for example, in the year 2000, in a case called Stenberg versus Carhart, the Supreme Court struck down a Nebraska law prohibiting so-called partial birth abortion. The Nebraska law prohibited the removal of a living fetus or substantial part of a living fetus with the intent of ending the fetus's life. That was a 5-4 decision. Justice Breyer wrote, joined by Justice Stevens, Justice Souter, Justice Ginsburg, and Justice O'Connor. In 2007, a case came before the Supreme Court, Gonzalez versus Carhart, that involved the federal partial birth abortion ban act. In the 2000 case, Stenberg versus Carhart, the majority said if the government is going to prohibit this procedure, there must be an exception to allow it where the health of the woman would make this the safest form of abortion. The federal partial birth abortion ban act has no exception for the health of the woman. Nonetheless, the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision in 2007, upheld the law. What's the difference from the 2000 case to the 2007 case? The only difference is, again, Justice Alito replaced Justice O'Connor. And so the five justices in the majority in Gonzalez, and it's now a familiar group to you, were Justice Kennedy writing, joined by Roberts, Scalia, Thomas, and Alito. The court changed many aspects of the law of abortion in that 2007 case, all of which will make it much easier for the government to regulate abortion up to the point of a complete prohibition. A second area that divides liberals and conservatives in our society concerns separation of church and state. During the Rehnquist years, there were four justices, Chief Justice Rehnquist, and also Justices Scalia, Thomas, and Alito, who vehemently rejected the idea that there should be a wall that separates church and state. Their view was that we should accommodate religion into government and government into religion. The view they took in many cases was that the government violates the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, the provision that prohibits government taking actions respecting the established religion, only if it literally establishes a church or coerces religious participation. Think about that standard. If the government violates the Establishment Clause, only if it literally establishes a church or coerces religious participation, little will violate the Establishment Clause. In 2005, I argued a case in the Supreme Court that involved a Ten Commandments monument. It's 6 foot high, 3 foot wide, and it sits directly at the corner between the Texas State Capitol and the Texas Supreme Court. The case is called Van Orden versus Perry. In an oral argument, Justice Kennedy said to me, with real anger in his voice, if your client doesn't like the Ten Commandments monument, why doesn't he just look the other way? Well, of course, there's no stopping point then. A city could put a large cross atop City Hall and say, if you don't like it, just look the other way. I think there are now 5 votes for that position that only had 4 in the Rehnquist years. I think that Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito will join Justice Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas in this regard. Assuming I am right, it will mean a dramatic change in the law with regard to religion and government. It will mean a rejection of the notion of a separation of church and state. I think what you're likely to see is the court allowing religious symbols on government property. government aid to religious schools so long as the government doesn't discriminate among religions, and much more of a religious presence in public schools. And if you focus on the examples that I've talked about, whether it's matters such as gun control, campaign finance, rights of criminal defendants, abortion, separation of church and state, these are really the issues that define who's liberal and who's conservative. And the Supreme Court has moved constitutional law dramatically to the right. I don't mean to say that every case comes out in a conservative direction. Sometimes Justice Kennedy sides with the more liberal justices. Sometimes there's even a more lopsided majority in a liberal direction. But overall, this is the most conservative court that there's been since the 1930s. Since Richard Nixon ran for president in 1969, it's been the goal of every Republican president, for that matter, every Republican candidate for the nomination, to remake the Supreme Court in a conservative direction. Much more than I think people have realized, they have succeeded. The conservatives have remade almost every area of constitutional law. It's easy to miss it, because it happens case by case incrementally. Roe versus Wade has never been overruled. But this is the most conservative court that there's been in decades. Well, fourth and finally then, what's the Obama presidency likely to mean for the future of constitutional law? Let me start by talking about what are the two newest justices likely to mean for the future of constitutional law. As I said, 2 weeks from yesterday, Elena Kagan, for the first time, will take a seat on the bench at the Supreme Court. The conventional wisdom is that Elena Kagan, in most cases, will vote the same way as the justice she's replaced, John Paul Stevens. I'm more skeptical of that conventional wisdom. I don't think we know enough to have a sense of what Elena Kagan's likely to be as a Supreme Court justice. The advantage that Elena Kagan offered to President Obama is that she had almost no paper trail. As a result, she was sure to be an easy confirmation. With 59 Democratic senators, and with no history of filibustering Supreme Court nominees, it was likely that whoever President Obama picked would get confirmed. But Elena Kagan offered the advantage that she'd require little in the way of political capital to secure a confirmation. She'd never been a judge before going on to the Supreme Court. Now, to be sure, that's not disqualifying. Many justices through history had never been on any bench before going to the Supreme Court. Think of Louis Brandeis, Hugo Black, Felix Frankfurter, William Douglas, Robert Jackson, Earl Warren, more recently, William Rehnquist and Lewis Powell. They'd never been judges before becoming Supreme Court justices. But the fact that Elena Kagan had never been a judge meant there weren't prior judicial opinions to scrutinize. Samuel Alito had been a Third Circuit judge for 15 years. There were countless opinions to read and talk about. Sonia Sotomayor had been a judge for a decade. Same thing. Nor had Elena Kagan written very much as a law professor. She had 5 major law review articles, and none said anything controversial. Unlike some law professors, she didn't write op-eds and give opinions in the media on controversial subjects. As I think was predictable, the confirmation hearings didn't give us any sense of Elena Kagan's ideology. My favorite moment during the confirmation hearings was on the Tuesday when Senator Lindsey Graham said to her, and I quote, "Where are you on Christmas?" And she responded, "Like most Jews, I'm in a Chinese restaurant." It was witty and clever, but didn't give us much sense of where she is with regard to the separation of church and state. So the disadvantage that Elena Kagan posed to President Obama is neither he nor anyone else can really know where she is on the ideological spectrum. People assume she'll be about where Justice Stevens was, but maybe she'll be a good deal more moderate. Possibly she'll be more liberal. There's no way to know. This, of course, was President Obama's second pick for the Supreme Court. The prior nominee was Sonia Sotomayor. The year before, David Souter retired from the court at the relatively young age for a justice of 69 years old. Last year, Justice Sotomayor was as consistently liberal as any of the justices on the court. She did vote almost every case, as we'd have expected David Souter would have voted. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, at age 77, is now the oldest of the justices. A year ago, she was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, though the media has reported thankfully was caught at the earliest stage. But maybe because she's so frail in appearance, there's always speculation she might step down. But if President Obama gets to replace her, it's likely to be with somebody of about the same ideology. In fact, if the Republicans take the Senate in November, or if the Democratic majority substantially narrows, President Obama might need to pick somebody significantly more conservative than Justice Ginsburg. Now think of the other side of the ideological aisle. John Roberts turned 55 in January of this year. If he remains on the Supreme Court until he's 90 years old, the age at which Justice Stevens stepped down, John Roberts will be Chief Justice into the year 2045. Samuel Alito turned 60 on April 1st of this year. Clarence Thomas has been on the Supreme Court 19 years, but he's only 62 years old. Both Antonin Scalia and Anthony Kennedy turned 74 this past summer. I think the best predictor of a long lifespan is being confirmed for a seat on the United States Supreme Court. So it's not likely that any of these five justices, Roberts, Scalia, Kennedy, Thomas, Alito, will be going anywhere between now and January 20th, 2013, even if there's a second Obama term, between now and January 20th, 2017. The vacancies for President Obama are Souter, Stevens, and perhaps Ginsburg. And that's not going to change the overall ideology of the court. Now, to be sure, in the long term, Justices Sotomayor and Kagan can be part of a more liberal majority, depending on who wins future presidential elections and who's picked for the court. And I don't in any way lessen the fact that every new justice changes the court. When Byron White was a justice on the court, he said, every time there's a new justice, it's a different court. Of course, that's true. The court is a small group, and changing one member of a small group does alter the dynamics. And this is a different court than we've seen before. For the first time in American history, there are three women on the Supreme Court. In Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan. For the first time in American history, there are two justices of color, Clarence Thomas and Sonia Sotomayor. For the first time in American history, there's not a Protestant justice on the court. There are six Catholic justices and three Jewish justices. I think for the first time in American history, there's no justice on the court who'd done active military service. Justice Stevens had served in the military in World War II, but to my knowledge, none of these nine justices had ever served in the military. Four of the current justices had served primarily as law professors before going on the bench. It's true of Justices Scalia, Ginsburg, Breyer, and Kagan. That might explain why the opinions get ever longer, why there's always so many more footnotes. But I think the bottom line, as you think about the Roberts Court last year and the term that'll begin on October 4th, or for the foreseeable future, is that if you're a politically conservative, this is a court you should cheer for. Remember the statistic I told you. Justice Kennedy sides with the conservatives significantly more than twice as often as with the liberals. And if you're politically liberal, well, maybe then you should be glad that the court's deciding only about 73 or 67 cases a year. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. As I promised, I'm glad now to use the remainder of our time together take questions about what I covered or aspects of constitutional law that in a 45-minute talk I couldn't cover. Please. In the very back.
I can sit out loud. Everybody hear me? Thank you so much for your comments. Very interesting. And I was especially interested in your comments about the separation of church and state.
Okay.
There's this very important case, Dover, that you're aware of, I'm sure, as it was mentioned earlier. I was wondering if somehow that case ended up percolating up to the Supreme Court. Where do you think the court would stand on Judge Jones's decision?
I think Judge Jones would surely get affirmed. The Supreme Court, in a case called Epperson versus Arkansas, struck down a law that prohibited the teaching of evolution. The court said that the law that prohibited the teaching of evolution had as its purpose advancing religion. Then the court had a case, Edwards versus Aguillard, that involved Louisiana law that required so-called balance treatment. It required that every time evolution was taught, creationism had to be taught. And the Supreme Court in that case, with only one dissenting justice, said that evolution is a scientific theory. Creationism is a religious account for the origin of human life. There's no secular purpose for teaching the religious theory. Certainly, people can learn the religious theory in their churches, their synagogues, their mosques. They can believe it. But the Supreme Court said there's no secular purpose for the teaching of creationism. But Judge Jones did, and he's sitting here, so I don't mean to speak for him, but in a very long and very thorough and well-reasoned opinion, he said that intelligent design is really creationism under another label. And I'm paraphrasing you, and so... But basically he said that it's the same purpose of advancing religion that the Supreme Court said was impermissible in Edwards versus Aguillard. I think that the split in the court today would be much narrower than it was in Edwards versus Aguillard. But I think that Justice Kennedy here would be much more likely to side with the liberals. Because Justice Kennedy is much more willing to exclude religion from public schools than, say, Justice Scalia. Let me tell you why I think that and what it means for what I'm saying is to the Establishment Clause. And here I'd point to another case. This is one from 1992, a case called Lee versus Weissman. It arose in Rhode Island. It involved a middle school. And the middle school had the practice of inviting a clergy member to deliver an invocation, a benediction. And the Weissman family had older children who graduated middle school, and they went to the principal and they said that we know that you have a clergy member deliver an invocation before the public school graduation. We think that violates the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. The principal said, I hear you. We'll invite your rabbi to come and deliver the invocation. And they said, no, you don't understand. It's not that we want our rabbi rather than a priest or a minister. We don't think that there should be a prayer at a public school graduation. Well, the school went ahead with it anyway, and the Weissman sued. And the decision in the Supreme Court was 5-4 that if clergy delivered prayers at public school graduations violates the Establishment Clause. Here, Justice Kennedy wrote for the court, joined by the four more liberal justices. And Justice Kennedy said, there's something inherently coercive about public schools. He said, as to graduation, though nobody's required to be there, graduation is an important event in a child's life. He said that it's not realistic to ask a child to leave the stage when there's the prayer and then come back afterwards. Then, 8 years later, the court had a case that involved student-delivered prayers at high school football games. And again, Justice Kennedy sided with the liberal justices in finding that this violated the Establishment Clause. So I think that Justice Kennedy, much more than the conservatives, is willing to exclude religion from the public schools. And so I think Justice Kennedy would side with the liberal justices to affirm Judge Jones. Please. Oh, microphone.
You spoke at length about the importance of the swing vote of Justice Kennedy, and Chief Justice Roberts went to great lengths to say that he considers himself to be an umpire who calls balls and strikes. Why don't we see more moderate nominees for the Supreme Court?
I think, first, and I know this is strong language, but John Roberts should be ashamed of himself for saying that judges, justices, are just umpires that call balls and strikes. It's the justices that make the rules. They define the strike zone. Let me give you examples. Does a clergy-delivered prayer at a public school violate the Establishment Clause? That requires a judgment call. It's not as if there's any clear answer to the question. Does a Ten Commandments monument at the seat of Texas state government violate the Establishment Clause? There's no clear answer to that question. Is the Second Amendment about a right to have guns for militia service, or does it include something broader? There's no clear answer to that. First case I ever argued to the Supreme Court involved a man by the name of Leandro Andrade, who was sentenced to 50 years to life in prison for stealing $153 worth of videotapes from Kmart stores in Southern California. He received this sentence under California's three strikes law, even though he had never committed a violent crime, because in California, a third strike can be any felony, and petty theft can be a felony under the circumstances such as this. No one in the history of the United States had ever received life in prison for shoplifting until California's three strikes law. The question is this cruel and unusual punishment? The justices can't decide that in a way an umpire decides calling balls and strikes. The justices have to decide what is cruel and unusual punishment. And I lost that case 5-4. And Andrade's not eligible for parole until the year 2046, when he's 87 years old. Now, John Roberts said that at the beginning of the confirmation hearings for obvious reasons. He wanted to say to the senators, my views don't matter. So the fact that I'm not going to tell you my views during the confirmation hearing shouldn't be a problem, because all I am is a justice calling balls and strikes. All the time, Judge Jones, all federal and state judges, have to decide whether or not the police were acting reasonably with regard to a search or an arrest. That's a judgment call. It's not about whether the pitch is too high or the runner beats the throw at first base. Why don't we have more moderate justices? I think that to some extent that reflects that we are at a time when our society is particularly ideologically divided. I think the more ideologically defined the president, the more ideologically defined the judicial picks. So, for example, Dwight Eisenhower wasn't a particularly ideologically defined president. So he picked a Democrat, a justice from the New Jersey Supreme Court, William Brennan, for the United States Supreme Court. Could you imagine today a Republican president picking a Democrat or a Democratic president picking a Republican? Dwight Eisenhower picked Earl Warren, a liberal Republican, for the Supreme Court. John F. Kennedy was less of an ideologically defined president than we might think. He was much more moderate than many believe. He picked Byron White, who was a conservative Democrat, fairly conservative in all his years on the Supreme Court. On the other hand, Ronald Reagan was an ideologically defined president. George W. Bush was an ideologically defined president. Doesn't surprise us, then, that they would pick much more conservative individuals for the court. Barack Obama picked individuals who are fairly liberal on the political spectrum, as best we can tell, or certainly that's so with regard to Sonia Sotomayor, or less, we know, with regard to Elena Kagan. So I think in an ideologically defined time, an ideologically defined president is more likely to pick somebody who's ideological. Now, there's one qualification here that could matter enormously. This is so long as the president and the Senate are of the same political party. It's when the Senate is of a different political party than the president that the president's latitude for selection is limited. So it's not surprising that in 1987, when President Reagan picked a conservative, Robert Bork, and there was a Democratic Senate, they rejected him. Or in 1969, when Richard Nixon picked Clement Haynsworth and Harold Carswell, and there was a Democratic Senate, they rejected him. If there is a Republican Senate beginning in January, then President Obama's ability to pick somebody who's liberal will certainly be limited. Please. And I know there's a microphone. Or I can repeat the question. There's a microphone.
Oh. Hi. So something I was wondering about that hasn't come up yet in your discussion today is whether or not you believe the Roberts Court, or as you put it, the Kennedy Court, would utilize the Commerce Clause of the Constitution to strike down either the entire health care bill that was passed this past March, or at least the section of that bill that requires everyone to purchase health care coverage. do you believe that, A, that portion of the bill is unconstitutional under that provision of the Constitution? And B, do you believe this current Supreme Court would take the step of striking it down as unconstitutional?
Sure. As you know, there's a case pending in federal district court in Virginia. And about a month ago, the federal court denied the government's motion to dismiss the case. And there's a lawsuit pending by about a dozen states in Florida, also in federal district court there. You asked me two-part question, A, my own views, and then B, what I think the court's going to do. As to my own views, I think that it is constitutional. The Supreme Court has long said that Congress can regulate economic activity which, taken cumulatively, has a substantial effect on interstate commerce. Well, the health insurance industry is certainly economic activity. Buying or even not buying health care is economic activity. And taken cumulatively, there's a $1 trillion effect on the economy. The last major Supreme Court case about the scope of Congress' power to regulate commerce among the states was Gonzalez versus Raich in 2005. It involved whether Congress could criminally prohibit and punish cultivation of small amounts of marijuana for personal medicinal use. And the Supreme Court, 6-3, with even Justice Scalia in the majority, said that Congress could prohibit people from growing or having small amounts of marijuana for personal medicinal use, because the court said, well, marijuana is a crop that's bought and sold in interstate commerce, albeit illegally, and looked at cumulatively, homegrown marijuana can have an effect on interstate commerce. If Congress can regulate a person growing marijuana for personal use, then surely Congress can regulate a $1 trillion industry. I don't think the Supreme Court is going to say there's a right to not purchase health insurance. Since 1937, the court has said the government can regulate economic transactions so long as the government's acting reasonably. Everybody realistically at some point is going to need health care. The government requires children be vaccinated. If an adult has a communicable disease, the government's going to require treatment. If somebody's in an automobile accident and they're taken to the emergency room, they'll be treated. So I think the court is very likely to uphold this. Now, I have to admit, in answering your B point, my prediction that the court's going to uphold it, I always find it difficult to separate what I think the court should do from my prediction of what the court will do. But I think it would take a dramatic change in the law with regard to the Commerce Clause to find this unconstitutional. I think the court's going to limit Congress's commerce power, as the Rehnquist Court did, but I don't think this will be the occasion for it, because it really is a $1 trillion industry. Other questions? There's another question here. Please, I think the microphone is coming to you. It does.
And so I was wondering about your classification with regard to freedom of speech versus privacy.
Sure. The case is Snyder versus Phelps, and it'll be argued this term in the Supreme Court. It involves a very small church. I think the church has 18 members, all from the same family, the Westboro Baptist Church. They go to funerals, people who died in military service, and they use those funerals as the occasion to express very strongly anti-gay messages. It's not that the soldiers who died were gay, it's they use the funeral as the occasion for saying that the reason why the life was taken was God was punishing the United States for its position with regard to gays and lesbians. The members of the Westboro Baptist Church went to such a military funeral. They expressed this message, and the father of the person who died then sued for, among other things, intentional infliction of emotional distress and invasion of privacy. The United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit ruled that such civil liability violates the First Amendment, and the Supreme Court granted review. It's a difficult case. On the one hand, there's certainly the need to protect the privacy and sensibility of the family. On the other hand, civil liability for speech has long been recognized as something that will chill expression. My prediction is I think the Supreme Court is going to affirm the Fourth Circuit and say that civil liability here violates the First Amendment. I think the court's going to say there are things that the government can do to protect privacy and sensibilities at funerals. The government can create a buffer zone around the funeral, just as the court has allowed buffer zones around reproductive health care clinics. But there can't be civil liability just because the speech is offensive. Once we go down that path, then anytime somebody is deeply offended and suffers emotional distress, there could be liability. The last time the Supreme Court has dealt with civil liability based on intentional infliction of emotional distress was a case called Falwell versus Hustler. It involved Hustler magazine publishing a caricature ad about Jerry Falwell having his first sexual experience with his mother in an outhouse. And Falwell sued Larry Flint and Hustler magazine for intentional infliction of emotional distress. The United States Supreme Court unanimously ruled in favor of Hustler. The Supreme Court said that creating liability for intentional infliction of emotional distress will chill speech and is punishing speech. We can't have liability just because the speech is offensive. So I think the Supreme Court will say there are things that the government can do to protect privacy, sensibilities at funerals, but civil liability of this sort violates the First Amendment. But we'll see. The case will be argued this fall, likely decided this spring. Other questions, please.
Oh. Ma'am, I'm sorry. We have a student back there who's been waiting for the microphone. 1 second.
Okay. What do you believe is the single most important Supreme Court case in U.S. history?
Marbury versus Madison, 1803. Because Marbury versus Madison is the case that said that courts have the authority to strike down federal laws, even acts of the president as violating the Constitution. The Constitution nowhere says that. In England, there's never been the power of courts to strike down acts of Parliament. I think that the ability of the courts to enforce the Constitution is what makes the Constitution meaningful. I think without judicial review, the Constitution would be little more than the words on parchment under glass in Washington.
We just have time for one more question.
Okay.
I think there's one.
I'm really interested in your description of the Supreme Court as the Kennedy Court, and also your description of the court in general as supporting corporate rights. I'd be interested in your explanation for why Justice Kennedy came down the way he did in Caperton, which similarly involves corporate support for an elected official, in that instance, a judicial official.
Sure. It's a case from 2009, Caperton versus Massey Cole. Did you ever read the John Grisham book, The Appeal? This is that book come to life. A jury in state court in West Virginia issued a $50 million judgment against Massey Coal Company, one of the largest coal companies in not only West Virginia, but the United States. The officials of Massey Coal spent $3 million of their own money to get their preferred candidate, Brent Benjamin, elected to the West Virginia Supreme Court. This was a large percentage of all of the money that had been spent on Brent Benjamin's campaign. Benjamin defeated the incumbent justice by 50,000 votes. Lo and behold, what comes before the West Virginia Supreme Court? Massey Cole's appeal of the $50 million judgment against it. Caperton's attorneys were not fools. They moved to have Justice Benjamin recuse himself. Justice Benjamin refused. He said it could be fair and impartial. The West Virginia Supreme Court, in a 3-2 decision, overturned the jury verdict. Justice Benjamin was in the majority. The issue before the Supreme Court was whether it violated due process for Justice Benjamin to participate. And the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that it violated due process. Justice Kennedy wrote, joined by Justices Stevens, Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer. The dissent was Roberts, Scalia, Thomas, and Alito. And so your question then is, why did Justice Kennedy join the majority? I remember in law school when I first heard the phrase, shocks the conscience. The facts of this case shock my conscience. My surprise was not that Justice Kennedy went along with the majority, that the case was not 9-0. That if we have any notion of due process in avoiding the appearance of unfairness, wouldn't this say that Justice Benjamin shouldn't participate in overruling the verdict against Massey Cole? It goes back to the other question. Judges and justices, they're not just umpires calling balls and strikes. They have tremendous discretion. And when you have someone elected under these circumstances then participating, there's at least the appearance of impropriety. I think it says a great deal about the dissenting justices that it didn't shock their conscience. Thank you again so much.